Welcome, everybody. I think we're almost all here by now. So I would just, first of all, like to thank all of you for coming, all of you that came from afar and from nearby as well. Shape dynamics is a nascent field. It's not very old, doesn't go that far back, but you already have some interesting results. And we are hoping that with this mixture of people, we can also get some, you know, cross-fertilization and some exchange of ideas. And hopefully will benefit all of us. And so for the first talk, we're going to have Julien, who is greatly responsible for bringing many of us together initially as well and keeping us going. His determination is an example for all of us in pursuing these topics. And well, without much further ado, let me introduce Julien. Go ahead, Julien.
Right, now I got it. I guess something over half of the people here do know quite well what shape dynamics is, and the other half don't. So what I thought I'll do is try and make it as simple as possible, my talk, and just review the key ideas of shape dynamics, and then go on to what seemed to me the exciting prospects and also the problems that we face. And break up the talk, starting with something like, I hope, a 10-minute introduction, and I'm hoping Enrique can be a tough chairman. And then after the introduction, go on to four topics. I doubt if I'll get through to number five, and that's the one I'm least interested in getting across. And make that a mixture of do each of the 4 points separately, with me talking and then inviting questions and comments from my collaborators, questions from those who are not so familiar with these things. So let me start off by saying, actually, I think the entire excitement of shape dynamics now in those of us who are actively working on it comes from just one simple thing, to say there is no absolute scale in the universe. Everything must be based on ratios of lengths and angles. And it seems to me very remarkable what that may do. And I'm actually writing a popular science book about this rather ambitiously. And the last few months, I've been actually studying the discovery of thermodynamics in the 19th century and the development of statistical mechanics. And it has struck me two things which might be very relevant. We know that in the 19th century, they introduced the notion of the ether, and then that was abolished. Now, first of all, there was something very similar, that what really triggered the birth of thermodynamics was the destruction of the notion of caloric. People used to think that heat was an indestructible substance, and gases would expand because caloric had come into the substance and it caused it to expand. It had become latent. That's why you couldn't, that's latent heat, was actually caloric had become invisible. But in becoming invisible, it had insinuated its way into the things, the atoms or whatever, the substance of the material, and made it expand. And I would suggest, first of all, that actually distance may be analogous to caloric, that distance is not anything physical. It's actually a sort of a gauge degree of freedom. And this seems to us, first of all, to have a very far-reaching implications. Now, the other thing that is really striking about the whole of the literature of thermodynamics and thermostatistics and the discussion of the problem of the arrow of time is that, as far as I can see, virtually all of it, I've seen very little in the way of any doubt about it, is actually still completely stuck in the way that thermodynamics was discovered through the work of Sadi Carnot trying to understand how steam engines work. And steam engines work because the steam is in a box. You can't talk about thermodynamics the pressure, the temperature, the volume, unless you've got the steam, the working medium in a box. And so a box plays a huge role in this whole discussion. And I think that is actually like the ether in some senses. That's something that is supporting what's going on inside the box. And in fact, in quantum mechanics, it's absolutely crucial that you need boundary conditions. So you have to have somewhere where you can impose boundary conditions. And that happens through boxes, basically. And it's very revealing that you read papers on statistical mechanics, quantum statistical mechanics, they talk about a system and a universe. And actually what they mean by the universe is actually a subsystem of the universe. It's actually, there's some very nice papers on this. Their system is actually just a subsystem of a larger Hilbert space. And the larger Hilbert space I don't think can exist without some sort of box which defines boundary conditions. So those are two things, and I think they potentially can put a completely different light on the way we should think about things. So let me now come on to the key ideas of shape space. So shape space is our key notion, and there are two shape spaces we'll be discussing. One is the shape space for the Newtonian n-body problem, which is taken in as an example, which illustrates things. And the other is going to be conformal superspace, the space of closed Riemannian manifolds quotiented by diffeomorphisms and conformal transformations. That gives you a point in conformal superspace. So let me just concentrate, first of all, on the n-body shape space for the three-body problem. And this is actually going to be for just three particles for simplicity. They are equal mass, assumed to be equal mass shown here. Now, if you take out scale, then the three-body problem has only 2 degrees of freedom because a triangle its shape is defined by 2 internal angles. So there's 2 degrees of freedom to describe that. So what we have here is actually a representation of the possible shapes of that a triangle can have. So each point on this sphere corresponds to a possible shape of a triangle. So at the top you have the equilateral triangle. So the equator are the limiting cases of collinear triangles, and all the points at the top that have the same latitude as points at the bottom, but the same longitude, opposite latitude, they are mirror images of each other. So there's 2 different congruences classes when you cross over you cross from one to another when you cross the equator. So those are all possible shapes of the three-body problem that are represented there. And on shape space, you can define at least 3 quite natural and interesting metrics. And the first one is a very is a neutral one, and that's the one that is shown here. It's essentially, you take the Newtonian kinetic energy, dr dotted into dr, and then you divide it by the center of mass moment of inertia. The center of mass moment of inertia that's one way of representing it. It's essentially twice, or is it half, the trace of the moment of inertia tensor. So you get something which is scale invariant, and then you can define a very natural metric on there, which is, so to speak, neutral. It doesn't represent any forces, and that has geodesics associated with it, and that's the closest you can get to something like inertial motion on shape space. It's the geodesics of that neutral metric, but then you can multiply it and take, you then say, can I define a measure of complexity? All I've got is just points in space, in Euclidean space, and I want to say whether they're clustered or not. How can I do that? And I want that to be a scale invariant quantity. And that actually turns out to be very interesting. There are 2 very natural lengths that you start with, mass weighted lengths. One is the root mean square length, which is essentially the center of mass moment of inertia that I talked about. So you just take all the separations between the particles, you square them, you multiply them by, you say, MAMB, RAB squared, divide by the square of the total mass, and then you take the square root. So that's a measure of the average size. So Rm root mean square length is basically half the width of you lot sitting there. And that changes very little. It changes very little when I move, because none of you are moving. It's very insensitive to clustering, that quantity. The other one is the mean harmonic length, which is actually the inverse of the Newton potential. And that quantity changes very sensitively. If I go up to Enrique and kiss him, then it gets really very large. That's a very interesting quantity. And it's rather interesting that the most natural quantity you can take is really the normalized Newtonian potential. So that's there. Am I running out of time already?
Your first
10 minutes. All right, let's see if I go on. So the aspirations of shape dynamics is to... I'm going to take more time, obviously. Never mind. What I say is to the most... what I call the most parsimonious law would be, can I define a sensible physical law where a point in a direction defines a trajectory on shape space? That's the minimum thing. That would be a geodesic thing. Now, it turns out that you can't do that. You need just one more bit of information to define an interesting thing. So let's go on. And then there's no idea of an external time here. So all you're going to get is just a curve on shape space. It's going to be undirected and unparametrized. And everything we think about time, chronology, all of those things have got to be extracted from the way the shapes change as you go along that curve. And you've got to see how local physics arises from it. And that's very different, really, from what Einstein and gauge theorists do following Faraday and Maxwell. They start with local laws of physics. They take local laws of physics as found here and then see what universes are compatible with that. But shape dynamics doesn't have to recover all of Newtonian solutions, all of Einsteinian solutions, or all Newtonian solutions. It only has to recover the ones that describe the actual universe. And we think that it may be more illuminating and more predictive. A really key thing now, and is why that picture of Janus was at the start of the thing, is there's a fundamental relation which was first discovered with the three-body problem by Lagrange in 1772. It's the n-body people call it the Lagrange-Jacobi relation. If your potential is homogeneous of some degree k, so this is the definition of a potential which is homogeneous of degree k, then it's a two-line proof. Not even that, you just use Newton's second law to show that the second derivative of the center of mass moment of inertia is equal to the center of mass energy minus this expression here. Now, if that is positive, or rather non-negative, the Newton potential is negative definite, and k is minus 1. It follows from that that the moment of inertia, the second derivative, is strictly positive. And that means that the moment of inertia is U-shaped upwards, and its derivative, its first-time derivative, which I coined the expression dilatational momentum. Rather remarkably, this quantity never got a name. It's just called J by the n-body specialists. But it's got exactly the same dimensions as the angular momentum. And this quantity is monotonic, and it vanishes just once. And that's what we call a Janus point. And this is, we think, very, very interesting and has all sorts of implications. It means that every single solution divides in exactly two parts, just one unique point in the middle. And that respects the time reversal symmetry of the underlying equation in that way there. And it exists for all n-body solutions with non-negative energy.
So what does that mean, that D equals zero? What does that mean physically?
Sorry?
What does that mean physically, that D equals zero? What's the...
It means that there is no energy in overall expansion, and all the energy, the Machin requirement cuts out any energy in angular momentum. So there's only two contributions to the energy. One is change of shape, and one is change of size. And in the Newtonian picture, just at that one unique point, There is no energy in change of size. It's all in change of shape. Now, that dilatational momentum, just to say, that is not conserved because the Newton potential is homogeneous of degree minus one. If it was degree minus two, then it is a conserved quantity. So it would be like the angular momentum. But you need a potential. That's a key thing there. So now let me just say why this is interesting. So all of this, if you have the three-body problem with zero energy, zero angular momentum, it is planar, and the nature of all of the solutions has been known for a century. They are all what's called hyperbolic elliptic escape, and what you have is in the distant past, say, you've got a single particle approaching a Kepler pair coming in the opposite direction. As they get to the common center of mass, there is complicated three-body interaction. That's the only place it is. And you may have a swapping of particles, as happens here, or they may stay the same. The Kepler pair may not break up. But then you go off in exactly the same way, the time reverse of it. You've got a new Kepler pair and a single particle going off there. And the time reversal symmetry, the way it's normally said, is, well, you can just put those, you can just reverse the arrows and you can go through the complete history in the opposite direction. However, we're saying that that should be interpreted a different way, because if we're going to talk about a direction of time, we've got to get it from the way the shapes change. So now what we say is actually, you should put the beginning of time at that point there and say that there are two distinct histories. This is one history and that's another history. They're qualitatively the same, so they respect the time reversal symmetry, but they are different in their details. So this is like a big bang, if you like. And as you go out here, you get a Kepler pair forming and structure forms. The orbital elements settle down ever better, and with respect to the Kepler pair that forms here, that makes a rod and a clock, and it defines a direction. And with respect to that, you see that this thing is going off in accordance with Newton's first law. So all of the Newtonian structure just emerges like this, and you can literally see it before your eyes, except that you can't see. It's only shapes that we say that are visible. So this is a curve. These are curves here showing. That's what the moment of inertia is doing. You can't see that directly. This is what the dilatational momentum is doing, and it's going through there. The thing that you can observe is how that complexity changes. And you see that it's sort of wiggling around there, and then it sets into a regular pattern here. It looks different on the two sides because the Kepler pair forms with different eccentricities on the two sides. So these are the fluctuations due to the eccentricity of the Kepler pair. This is a 1,000-body simulation here, where you see that the curve is greatly smoothed out. There's the Janus point there. And this is an artistic representation of what it's like. Here you have what is like a very smooth swarm of bees. And as you get away, in both directions, clusters form. And that's the sort of story, it's a different perspective. So that's that. So let's go on and see how we get on. So in fact, this has really already been covered there. I just will repeat that there. So the chronology comes, how do you order these things? So if I just gave you the Newtonian solution and throw them, jumbled all the successive configurations in a heap, and in fact only gave you the internal angles. So I give you pairs of internal angles. Even a child could order them in a linear sequence and say there's something special, then find there's a middle point, and then it goes out like that. So the chronology just comes out of the succession of shapes. The continuity is very important, and the way the shapes change. And as you get further and further, when you get out to this situation, you've got triangles where one length, one side is very short, and then the other two are very long. So they're like arrows or darts. And this is very distinctive. So these are arrows of time, which are very clearly expressed there. And as I've already mentioned, you get Newtonian frames of reference defined by the Kepler pair. It's rather striking. Gravity creates structure out of chaos. For internal observers, the only sensible choice for the direction of time is how this structure grows and orbital elements stabilize. So you have two opposite, these two branches of the history have opposite directions of time. So shall we, perhaps, yes, Eric.
So this may be too detailed of a question, so perhaps I should wait for later. I'm not sure what the convention is here for asking questions. But,
well, we've got to the stage where questions are welcome, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
If all there were gravitational interactions, then I would completely agree with you. But, you know, when nebula of dust start to collapse and form planets and stuff, gravity is almost irrelevant. Electromagnetism takes over. Everything that's happening in this room, all the arrows of time, all information processing, all thermodynamics, it's basically mediated by electrostatic charge, by electrostatic forces. So, I mean, is there a way to connect up what's happening on the large scale with this gravitational arrow of time with?
Well, if you look at the history of the universe, if you just look, first of all, at the large scale history of the universe, it looks really pretty like that picture here that we had here. And I think all of these things, quantum mechanics and electromagnetic interactions and things like that, these are all tending to helping to form clusters, to form bodies and things like that. And this, that complexity that I plotted there, I think if you took the, when we get to general relativity, we're going to say that in when we talk about space-time, we're going to hope that we will have space-time foliated by surfaces of constant mean curvature, which will define a notion of simultaneity. And I think it wouldn't be difficult to define something like that if you just took, say, where all the protons are in the universe on each of these time slices in a spatially closed universe. I'm pretty certain that it would grow in much the same way as we're seeing that there or that way there. And in fact, the fact that it does that and clusters form, the gravity and the quantum mechanics and the other forces will only help that. I mean, I think we know, I think the emergence from the so-called dark ages in cosmology happens when certain types of molecules begin to form and things like that. That all of those processes, as far as I can see, are helping it.
If you're in a regime where you want to say some of the force is dominant as well, you could happily replace the Newtonian potential with the Coulomb potential, and you do need to follow the dynamics
Dave, would you? The one thing I just wonder is about the non-negativity.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you get slightly different sets of results because you have negative charge, whereas gravity only has attraction. Mm.
Is there a way to guarantee that the clustering that happens mediated by electric charge or by electromagnetic forces is in the same kind of thermal direction as that might due to gravity?
Not necessarily, because you can think about having to say you have two electrons, for example, they would be repulsed by magnetism.
But there is, of course, a great tendency for neutral things to form. I mean, by and large, that's why gravity seems to be the dominant force here, because all the positive and negative charges are bound together and only affect each other very locally. This is still very early days. I mean, what I'm saying is, we may be in the stage of thermodynamics in 1850 when finally Clausius said there is no Clausius, there is no caloric, we should think about these, we should philosophize about these things differently, as Kepler said. Let's go on to the next slide, but thank you. I've already done that one there. Well, Tim, I think, is going to talk about this, so I'll go on. Sketch the thing. So this is a picture of one of the, by the way, thanks to Flavio for all of these diagrams. I'd be totally lost without Flavio's diagrams. This is actually showing, it's that one that we had before. It's exactly the same solution, but now plotted as an undirected, unparametrized curve on shape space. This is what it looks like. There at the back is the Janus point, and they all go the Janus point for the three-body problem can be anywhere on the shape sphere, and except for a set of measures zero, which doesn't really bother us too much, although Tim may say something about it, they all finish down these wells of, well, the complexity I defined it as positive, but it's also the normalized Newton potential. So it's a scale invariant Newton potential. And they all finish down that. Every single solution must come out and go down one of those. It can go back down the same one, or it can go down a different one. So it's a very clear, striking picture. Let me make one other observation. People, you'll find many comments in the literature on the arrow of time that gravity seems to be anti-thermodynamic. It tends things to cluster rather than to make things uniform. But remarkably, people always start off with a uniform state. I've only seen once ever an observation that actually, if you then reverse the time and went back again, you'd go through the most uniform state and come out into clustering the other side. It's just one place I've read where that's been up. You'll see countless comments on gravity being anti-thermodynamic because it creates clusters out of a uniform state, but not saying it'll do it in the other direction as well, going through the Janus point. So what Tim has shown is that the really striking thing is that you've got the shape curve, the curve on shape space. So you've got the shape degrees of freedom, you've got the scale degree of freedom, and you've got the time that's going at it. And the key thing that is so important in all this is that the shape part is autonomous. You get an independent set of equations which you can solve without worrying anything about the scale. Then they're complicated equations. Tim will go through them. But you can go through and you can find the shape curve. And then after that, you say, at this point, the scale is one, say. The size of the moment of inertia is one. That fixes your scale. And then the scale is fixed the whole way along. It's all there, just once. And if you did this, the analogous thing in space-time, you would just have to say the distance between two points at one instant is this value, and then the whole of the scale would be fixed for the whole of space-time. And then you pick a second point. So at one point, you say this is the scale, and then you say the second point, the distance between that is 1 second. And then just by quadrature, without solving any new equations, you get how time passes, what the passage of duration is. So that's the overall picture there. So it's saying that all of the guts, the heart of the thing, is in how the shape degrees of freedom, how the shape changes. And Tim is more or less got this done. And I think if nothing else, I've been interacting with N-body specialists for nearly 20 years now, and they are quite interested in what we've done. And I think Tim's paper, if nothing else, would be quite an interesting contribution to N-body theory, because this is a way of thinking about the N-body theory which had never occurred to people working in the N-body problem. So that's it there. So now let me talk about boxes and the origin of the second law. Do we want to have questions, any comments on that? We're about halfway through, so we're doing not too badly.
We have a whole discussion session later as well.
Yeah, so if there were any comments, yes?
Does the decoupling of shapes and scale work with the three-body problem or generally?
Absolutely general. Yeah, it'll go through for the N-body. 40 years ago, there was a paper showing what the asymptotic behavior of the N-body problem is. Typically, you get these clusters. And by the way, also, it tends to Hubble expansion. So Hubble expansion is nothing special in the N-body problem if it's with these relatively minor restrictions. There's no fine-tuning required. I mean, in the early days of cosmology, Weyl, back in 1923, wondered why there was, he has some postulate about all the galaxies coming out of a point at one stage. And in 1960, Hermann Bondi was worrying about Friedman, Roberts, and Walker. But as far as we can see, did I come on to this thing about the... No, the Liouville theorem is coming in a minute. So let me just now talk about the boxes and the origin of the second law. So as I already said at the start, you can't do standard thermodynamics without a box. It's absolutely crucial. You can't define the key quantities. You can't define entropy in that way. And if you read Gibbs's famous book from 1902 on the foundations of statistical mechanics, he says, I'm setting up a completely general formula with sort of Gibbs ensembles, the Gibbs phase, and things like that. But he said, I must make a restriction, which is not to do with actually that fundamental dynamics, but it's because I'm going to talk about probabilities. And I can only talk about probabilities if the system has access only to a phase space of bounded measure. That's putting it in modern terms. He says, I cannot treat a universe that can exist in infinite space, and the momentum must be bounded. They mustn't grow unboundedly. And that doesn't get noted. And in fact, if you look at Tolman, who praises Gibbs to the sky, but Gibbs says, Tolman says, if you have a system in a box, its entropy will tend to a maximum. If it's not in a box, the maximum entropy is one of infinite expansion and infinite dilution. And by the way, this is the position of people like Sean Carroll and Alan Guth, who say that's infinite expansion. That is when the entropy goes to maximum. But I think actually, unless you've got a phase space, a compact phase space bounded measure, you can't talk about probabilities. And that's where we think the box is so important. And this is where potentially shape dynamics does something very interesting. So let's go on. So what happens if you are in a box and you do it strictly, well, you get Poincaré recurrences. So this is going back to the famous debates between Boltzmann and Zermelo in the 1890s. So the free expansion, that one degree of freedom in the Newtonian picture where you can expand, is thwarted. So that's when you get equilibrium set in. But if you've got a finite number of particles and you wait long enough, you will get infinitely many Poincaré recurrences. And you get qualitative time reversal symmetry. These, of course, are infinitely long. And this was Boltzmann's famous suggestion in 1895, how he could reconcile the statistical theory that he was developing with the second law of thermodynamics. He's saying entropy is not going to increase forever monotonically, as many people argued it should. He's saying, well, every now and then there will be fluctuations, and just if you wait long enough, they can be big enough. So he suggested the universe is and rests forever in thermal equilibrium. Let me remark, you can find many discussions of the problem of arrow of time where either implicitly or explicitly people are making that assumption. And I should think it's an absolutely extraordinary assumption to say our universe, which we know is expanding, is in a box. But that's what's going on. That's what people are often saying. So Boltzmann then says, only near deep entropy dips are worlds where visible motion and life exist. The direction of time towards the more improbable state will be called the past. He doesn't quite explicitly say what I call one past, two futures, that if there are intelligent beings on this side, then there can equally well be on that side. And that will say that's the direction to the past, and they will say that's the direction to the past. And so, really, ever since Boltzmann, so this is now about 120 years, people have essentially adopted Boltzmann's idea that the second law of thermodynamics is due to a huge fluctuation in our remote past, or the Big Bang must have had a very low entropy, which is Roger Penrose's argument. But however, we think this is very different. So this is where actually two people here independently came up with the same observation, which is to do with Liouville's theorem. Now, the reason why in the 1890s Boltzmann had all these problems with Zermelo was because of Liouville's theorem and these eternal recurrences, that there wasn't a continuous growth of entropy and things like that. Because in accordance with Liouville's theorem, the Gibbs phase is conserved, phase space volume is conserved. Now, the observation that Dave Sloan made in connection with thinking about inflation, and Tim first in the discussions with Flavio and me realized that if you have in the extended space, you've got a Hamiltonian system in the extended space where there is scale. And in that extended space, Liouville's theorem will hold. But if within that the scale part is growing, which it does, then the shape part, the residual part, must decrease, which means there must be attractors on shape space. And my conjecture is it's perhaps a bit of a wild one. It's maybe the origin of all the arrows of time just goes back to that simple observation. The scale part of the universe is growing. The shape part must have attractors. And you see it here. You see it in this the simplest thing here. So here is every single solution of this case just has to finish up down there. Everywhere you put the Janus point, you will at least one and generally two ends of it will finish up down there. The measure zero set is when it goes off to the equilateral triangle or to the one of the special collinear configurations. So that's pretty striking, I think. But also this could be, so we from the general theory of the n-body problem, the asymptotics, clusters form. Now, if you've got a gravitational cluster formed, it makes its own box. It's confined by its self-gravitational potential. So there you've got the scope for the second law to set in, or behavior like the second law. So suppose we have a situation where we've got 100 particles, and we start them off at the Janus point, and after a while clusters are formed, and we get a three-body cluster formed. So in that cluster, we will have Poincaré-type recurrences. And it's Poincaré-type recurrences that are characteristically thermodynamic. That's what thermostatistics is about, is Poincaré recurrences, where you get these fluctuations. So already in the n-body problem, you can see how things like thermodynamics thermodynamic phenomena will arise. And then you, so typically I think the story for me of the universe is that the Big Bang is extremely uniform. As we evolve, we get clusters forming, structures form, and then objects form and then they decay. And this is what we see happening with radioactive particles, that they form sometime in the distant past and now they're decaying. And also you see this also with n-body clusters forming, just already with the three-body problem, you see it. Now, of course, this needs a lot of sharpening and so forth, but in one of those two papers on the start of the slides I showed, that was there's a reference to the paper that Tim Flavio and I put out. Right, so do we want to actually say anything about that before I go on to this one there? Does anybody want to come in on that? We're doing not too badly for time, I think.
Just a tiny comment. Maybe it's not enough just to say that the contribution to the Newtonian measure due to scale increases and therefore the shape part decreases. That's true, but the shape part will also decrease homogeneously and not do anything interesting. So a key role is played by the form of the shape, the potential on shape space, which really selects these attractors. There will be no attractors with a flat potential on shape space, of course.
Yeah, thanks. Yes, that's a very good point. Yeah, there will be attractors, but the form of the attractors will depend upon the forces. Yeah. Sean?
Yeah, so another thing it almost certainly exists a measure on shape space where the flow is just because it's a there are curves, the vertical curve, and they define vector flow. It might not be with respect to symplectic. It might not be a symplectic flow, but I'm almost positive there is a flow that could define a measure that is conservative. So I guess that way, the conclusion there's an attractor is the fact that you're picking a particular measure, which you believe will measure your projection. Yeah. So I wonder, how much of this...
It's a peculiar dynamics for the measure. If you take the scale invariant potential, which is just Newton times the power of the moment of inertia, you would get a symplectic flow on shape space because scale is conserved.
So what I'm saying is that I'm almost positive you would pick a measure where the flow would be conservative on shape space, even for this potential. So why not use that?
It depends on the dynamics. No?
Well, perhaps.
Anyway,
perhaps we should go on, because actually I was a little bit optimistic saying I was on time. I should get through the last two points fairly quickly. Yeah, right, okay. What have I got? Not about 10 minutes to, or 15, is it?
Yeah,
okay, but we're not doing too badly. Better than I've been. I'm just going to anticipate what I think will be Dave's talk on the third. I'm just going to give the punch. Yeah, okay. You can do the same sort of thing for Bianchi 9 if you've got a massless scalar field in it, quiescent Bianchi 9. So this is where I'm hoping to get some comments from you, Jim, at some stage. But basically, there seems to be a shape space with a shape potential on it for Bianchi 9, which is, the potential looks very different. But it seems to be possible to go through the Janus point, and in the three-body problem, the scale must go to zero or can go to zero if it happens at these stationary points of the shape potential up there and at the Euler configurations there. But otherwise, the Janus point can be anywhere. And the size of the universe found by quadrature will not go to zero, or need not go to zero. And Tim will be saying about that. It seems that in quiescent Bianchi 9, the Janus point must be on the equator. And by the way, there's in both cases, there's a change. Well, this is the congruence class of triangles changes as you cross the equator there. And it changes here. So I won't say any more about that because that's going to be Dave's talk, I think. But to whet your appetites, so we're hopeful that actually these ideas come from the three-body problem, could possibly go through, and might be extremely interested when coupled with the full BKL conjecture if it works. So Jim, we're really hoping for interaction with you on this. So let me go on to the next one. Now this is, what is interesting here, I think, is the following. Because the dilatational momentum in Newtonian theory is not conserved, and you can't see that. You can't see what the dilatational momentum, how much of energy is in change of size compared with change of shape. That is why a point in a direction is not enough to determine the Newtonian solution. So you specify a point in a direction, and then there will be a one-parameter family of Newtonian solutions which have the same point and direction, but they have a different curvature at that point, and they curve off it in a different way. So this is just one, but there would be infinitely many of those. But now the really interesting thing, I think, is that at the Janus point, there is no energy in overall expansion. It's all in change of shape. And that means that you can specify every solution by saying, at the Janus point, this is the point of the Janus point, and this is the direction the solution has. So you have complete control over the solution space for these things there. It looks as if you've got a sensible measure defined upon it, and you can really start, we believe, or we hope, start talking seriously about typicality of universes. What is a typical universe going to look like? Eric, yeah?
So I'm not a little confused about the measure issue after what Sean said. So is the measure here, you start with symplectic base space, you mod out by scale, and you project the Liouville measure down.
More or less, there is a problem in that it gets odd dimensional because you lose one thing. So in the previous slide, I said needs sharpening. So there is definitely, but I'll come on to this in a little bit. No, this is still at the level of, I use the word aspiration advisedly on slide two. But I think it's not inconceivable that it will work. But I think the fact that, let me just make one observation. I think if we're right, what we will have shown is that both Newton's theory and Einstein's theory are vastly more powerful than people had realized. That actually they contain with them a pretty good theory of initial data as well. Not uniquely fixing the initial data, but saying what the typical one will be like. And that therefore it will say what the typical universe will be like that's experienced. And moreover, it will say that although the law of the universe is time reversal symmetric, everybody inside the universe will get the impression that there was an origin of the universe, that there was a beginning of time, which would be the Janus point. And that, I think, has never been sort of suggested that that was sitting inside either Newton or Einstein. And this is all to do with just that one degree of freedom, the scale. That's all where the excitement is potentially is sitting in this situation. There's a lot of work to be done on that to tie it up. Let me go on to the next slide. Yes, now this is, so can we talk about entropy of the universe? A lot of people talk about the entropy of the universe. Clausius in 1865 says the two fundamental facts about the universe is the total energy is constant and the entropy tends to a maximum. But they had only the remotest idea of what the universe might be like. And lots of people still repeat the Clausius and say the entropy of the universe is tending to a maximum. But it's not in a box, so how are you going to do it? And moreover, let me go on to the next slide. So this one here. When does entropy really come into its own? It's when you've got a system in a box and you can pump energy into it. So these are plots of the Maxwell distribution for different energy. So they change qualitatively. This is the low energy one there, and most of the solutions are at low velocity, but you pump in more energy and you push it out there. And so the entropy, the volume of the momentum space gets increased. So that's to do with the fact that there is a scale in the story, and you can do that. And all of this is hugely important in ordinary physics, because essentially you're always dealing with systems which are either self-confined, they're solids like this table here, or they literally are in a box. And you can talk about that. But if you've got the whole universe, and we're talking, and I think it's arguable possibly in general relativity in this way we represent it, coming from York's work on the initial value problem, that there is a local energy density which is zero at every point. I think that is a possible interpretation of it. And certainly in the Newtonian model that we're dealing with, the energy is zero once and for all. So you can't have any effect like this with count of microstates due to the energy of the universe changing. But what will change is the complexity. So here you can actually literally see different levels of the complexity. So instead of using the energy as a state function and asking how many microstates correspond to a given energy, we're going to ask how many microstates correspond to a given complexity. And that in the three-body problem, it's just the length of these contour lines. And you see, if the great bulk of the three-body problem is away from these very special configurations where the triangle is very sharp and one side is very small compared with the other two. So you literally see how we called it the entaxy, the entropy-like quantity, which is the count of microstates, changes. So mostly you'll start off here in accordance with the measure. Now, and then as you go down here, actually the measure will get smaller. So the entropy-like quantity for the universe will not increase, it will decrease. And I think that's hard to avoid that conclusion. And the other thing is, once you've taken scale out, the universe puts itself into a box because you've got a compact phase space. So it completely inverts the normal way. But this can still be perfectly compatible with the normal second law of thermodynamics once you've got clusters formed and systems are separated out like that. But then you get the typical effect where you get sort of the central limit theorem or the law of large numbers. This is a plot that Flavio did, where you see how does the what's the complexity like, how many states have a given complexity. So as we go along here, the complexity is increasing, and this is where the sort of the density of states where you get a lot. So in the three-body problem, you have to go a long way before you've got half the states, and you go out to 1.5 times the minimal complexity. But the minute you start increasing the number of particles, you go up to 50 or 100, it peaks incredibly soon. So virtually all of the states have very low complexity. They're very uniform. So this suggests that the universe must start off extremely uniform. And that might be then an immediate explanation of the Copernican principle. The universe must look basically uniform. And to the extent that it's not uniform now, that's due to gravitational and other clustering that's happened since then. And that's where you would get the perfect behavior. So this is sort of a blindfold creator throwing things. I don't think I need, I've already said basically what's in there. But I do want to talk about this thing here. So these are the Maxwell distributions for different values of the energy. But basically, as far as I understand this right, and I talked this through with Tim and Vasu yesterday, basically these curves are all the same. If you say actually any one of them, I've just chosen a nominal normalization. It's just there. So basically, at the Big Bang, you would have something like you could have a dimensionless Maxwell distribution of velocities. So that's my conjecture. So does this actually mean there might be no need for inflation or what? And none of this is all purely classical. We haven't begun to think about quantum mechanics. So I think it just raises questions about how we should think about these things. I think, no, I won't go into that because I think I've done enough. So, right, thanks very much.
All right, we have a couple of minutes for questions, basically two quick ones, but we'll have a whole discussion session later today. After the morning.
Quick one, we're talking about spatially close, and somehow, obviously not an astronomer, but a cosmologist, but I keep hearing from those guys, they don't like to think about spatially close universes anymore. So, because of the accelerated expansion and all that, most of the models they talk about are spatially not close. So, how does one deal with that?
I think there may be two reasons for that. One is that was the discussion we were having yesterday, Tim and Vasu. Partly this is to do with difficulties in string theory and so forth, talking about spatially closed universes. I think it's that might be partly a theoretical
accelerated expansion.
Yeah, but a spatially closed universe can go on expanding forever. And it will look flatter and flatter as if once you've got things like Kepler pairs forming. I mean, you see this in the n-body problem, the asymptotic behavior of the n-body problem, except for so-called super hyperbolic escape, which I don't think we need worry about because that's when particles go off to infinity in finite time, which is barely compatible with special relativity. So I think we needn't worry too much about those situations in the n-body problem. But the n-body problem just asymptotes to Hubble-type expansion going on forever. And Kepler pairs form. So the Kepler pairs stay mutually congruent, but you don't have anything like a Bohr radius because their sizes can have arbitrary semi-major axes. However, when quantum mechanics comes in, then with luck we will have things like Bohr radii, and we really will have quantum rods and quantum clocks. And I see no reason why then we shouldn't be in the regime where the universe looks very flat. I mean, it looks flat to us here in Waterloo, doesn't it? The Earth, sorry, looks flat there. So I don't think it needn't be anything different from that. And it might be just a theoretician, theoretical bias. And I think the evidence...
In the end, in cosmology, all you need to worry about, if you have a closed model, is that in your fast light cone, the scale of curvature of the universe doesn't enter the fast light cone at some point, so that we would show as features, macroscopic features. There are these giant domain walls or stuff like that, structures that can show up if the universe is so small. But you can always make it larger. So it's a lower bound, and it's not, it can go up. So you can always make
a trite response, and you can always close the universe outside.
Of course you can. It's just I don't hear people talking about that anymore.
Yeah.
It's so much easier to work on a background that is flat, plain weight. But that's just calculational convenience.
I mean, in the standard situation, I would say in science, we make a bold hypothesis, and then we try and find the conclusions that follow from it, and then test them against observations. I live in hope that we could actually make a prediction on the assumption that the universe is spatially closed, and say then something must be observed, which we could observe. But this, whether that would happen tomorrow through some flash of genius from one of us here, or whether it'll be when I'm dead and pushing up the daisies, as we say in England, I don't know.
Wheeler would be happy.
You what?
Wheeler would be happy.
But it's a long, the first person who really seriously considered a spatially closed universe was Schwarzschild in a lovely paper in 1900, where he talked about the nice feeling of it being sort of self-contained. And it goes back to Cusanus in the Middle Ages saying, every point is the center of the universe. And then the first relativistic model is Einstein's. And Einstein says a spatially closed universe, you can close the circle of mechanical causes and effects and things like that. There's an awful lot to be said for it, isn't there? Yeah.
So one more quick question.
This is a question about the aspirations of shape dynamics. You mentioned at the very beginning, you said it doesn't need to predict all Einsteinian and Newtonian universes, just the actual one. But but when we use GR and Newtonian mechanics, we do a lot more than just basically try and model FLRW or something. We do black holes, we do black holes of jets, we do active galactic nuclear centers, we do distribution of galaxies, we do plasma fields, in nebula and interacting with CMB. So is the goal for shape dynamics really just large-scale cosmology, or do you really want to be able to write down models?
Oh yes, but in fact, actually, that is what
for all the different kinds of situations.
We certainly need to recover all of local physics, and this is again a bit of what Tim was saying, and I hinted at that. Once you get into this asymptotic regime where clusters have formed, and you've got Kepler pairs, you've got Newtonian frames of reference. And by the way, all of these clusters will have all of the conserved quantities that you need. So you will get all of standard Newtonian mechanics coming out of a... And in fact, the universe as a whole is described by a gauge theory, which you see because there are constraints. The total energy, the total angular momentum, and the total momentum are all zero. But then once you get subsystems forming, there's a gauge theory subject to Noether's theorem part two, but the subsystems are then governed by Noether's theorem part one. So you get all the conserved quantities, you get all the stuff that Gibbs does so beautifully. So actually we aim to recover all of standard Newtonian theory and also all of Newtonian theory locally, because Einsteinian theory. So it's only about what the law of the whole universe is like. Locally, we hope to recover the Einsteinian and the Newtonian behavior. And I think we've got a very good chance to do it. But of course, it's a much bigger task to really establish that in general relativity, for dynamical geometry. I think we're pretty well there with the Newtonian theory. I don't think we need worry too much on the front Newtonian front.
Okay, let's keep the rest of this discussion, and let's thank Julian again.
Okay.